Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Two guests up today on not unrelated topics, though it might not appear so at first. In a few minutes, we'll hear from Gar Lipow, independent scholar and author of a new book on how the solution to the climate crisis requires that we address economic decay and social polarization. And then at the bottom of the hour, Edward Luce, chief U.S. commentator for the Financial Times, will talk about his new book on U.S. economic decay and social polarization. Before that, some comments, not so much in the news, but on the topics at hand. As I've said here before, as we were entering the financial crisis and Great Recession, the first signs of which began appearing in the summer of 2007, almost 5 years ago, I thought that it might lead to some sort of rethink of the neoliberal approach to economic management that's prevailed for the last 30 years. Maybe not a wholesale transformation, but at least some signs of a rethink. Clearly, the increase in corporate profitability and the expansion of upper bracket incomes through the repression of mass living standards, assuaged with the liberal availability of consumer credit, is not a strategy that has the ring of long-term sustainability about it. But no rethink has happened in the mainstream. There's some hope that the Occupy movement, whose putative springtime revival is hard to evaluate, might force the issue, but the high and mighty are having no such second thoughts. They're still accumulating away, almost as if nothing happened, and there is nothing to worry about anymore. Also, before the Great Recession, I'd held out some hope that elites might be coming to some kind of consciousness on the climate crisis. Venture capitalists were intrigued by funding alternative energy schemes, and some corporations were even forming pressure groups on the issue. But when the recession hit, all that went out the window. Public opinion, too, at least until very recently, turned more skeptical and complacent as the economy soured, as day-to-day survival concerns eclipsed problems that were thought to be many years in the future. Though really, that future is already showing itself. I've thought all along that investment in new forms of transportation and energy and refitting our old buildings and infrastructure in climate-friendly fashion would be a wonderful way to return to something like prosperity while arresting the damage we've already done to the climate. But our political system is clearly incapable of thinking this through. It's scared, cramped, reactionary. Elites are doing well again, and they don't feel any threat from climate change. With money's lock in our politics and stupidity and meanness's lock in our discourse, polarization and decay seem to have the upper hand. It does not have to be this way. But it may be wrong to see this problem as inhibiting a reaction to decay. It may be a prime symptom of the decay itself. And if Occupy can't revive itself and grow, then life could get very ugly. Back to talk climate crisis and social change after a musical break. That was some of Stadtkind, City Child, though I'm wondering if City Kid would be more idiomatic, a 2001 song by Elena Lien, a love song of sorts to her hometown, Berlin. My first guest is Gar Lipow. Gar is author of Solving the Climate Crisis Through Social Change, Public Investment in Social Prosperity to Cool a Fevered Planet, just out from Prager. Back during the Cultural Cold War, Prager was something like the CIA's house publisher, but no longer. Gar is also the author of a self-published book, Cooling It, No Hair Shirt Solutions to Global Warming, which details very practical things we could do to cut greenhouse gas emissions drastically. You can find it on the web at nohairshirts.com, nohairshirts, all one word, .com. Gar's work shows that obstacles to living in material comfort without destroying the planet are social and political, and not technological. Gar Lipow. Welcome, Gar. In some of your earlier work, the website Cooling It, nohairshirts.com, you make the point that we could really have a whole different relationship with greenhouse gas emissions on existing technology. This is not rocket science, to use the cliche. What are some of the things holding us back from adopting these technologies that are right out there if we wanted to?
One of the big things is that greenhouse gases and pollution in general is actually a side effect of the way our economic system is set up. It's a side effect of, among other things, inequality, militarization. And it's not that, you know, you treat somebody unfairly or the rich have a huge gap between the rich and the rest of us that just somehow magically produces greenhouse gas emissions. But basically, maintaining that inequality, maintaining that militarization requires various structures in place to keep that going, and those structures also create waste. Would you like an example to make that a little more concrete?
Oh, absolutely.
Go back to the farm workers and the lettuce fields of California. In California, for a long time, farm work was done with something with the short-handled hoe, sometimes called El Cortito, the short one, devil's arm. And basically, it was 24 inches long. Farm workers reached down to harvest stuff, and it was extremely painful. It destroyed backs. And so eventually, as the United Farm Workers Union started to have some successes and gain some power, there was a movement to eliminate it. And farmers says, hey, wait a minute. You eliminate it, you'll put us out of business, which, you know, that seems to be something you always see when you're improving the lives of workers or ordinary people. Business always says, you'll bankrupt us, you'll drive us out of business. And then finally, in the 70s, a law was actually passed outlawing the short-handled hoe. And the day the short-handled hoe was outlawed and farm workers were weeding lettuces with the long-handled hoe, productivity rose 10%. Now, the big thing about that, of course, is it eliminated a horrible cruelty, but indirectly, that also saved resources, because if you're harvesting more lettuces per hour, then you end up having fewer truck trips back and forth to the field. Farm workers in California are driven to the fields in these big pickup trucks, and so that saves the fuel to move them back and forth. A lot of the productivity increases that there's less waste, that you're destroying fewer lettuces in doing the weeding, and so that's fewer pesticides and other resources, fertilizer going to grow the lettuce. An artificial fertilizer uses fossil fuels and has tremendous greenhouse gases as a side effect. In fact, you know, agriculture is a big part of greenhouse gas emissions, so anytime you cut the burden there, you're cutting it. And again, the most important point is that it ended the hideous cruelty, but it sort of shows as like a third-order effect of maintaining inequality that you actually create greenhouse gases. And another point, you can go deeper into the structure because, you know, if it would increase productivity 10%, why were the farmers, you know, the major industrial growers like Bud Antel, so concerned about maintaining the short-handled hoe? Well, one of the things about the short-handled hoe is when a worker is using it, you can see the muscles ripple when they weed. And so it's a supervisory tool, a monitoring tool. You can see immediately when they're working less hard. And so it's management labor relationships where they were getting this tremendously painful and destructive of tool being used by the workers because it helped maintain control so that they could monitor the workers better. That one story actually captures a lot about what happens with both greenhouse gases and pollution in general.
This is an example of also the way things are done in firms, larger corporate firms.
Oh, yes, very much. I mean, I have other examples from the computerization, but in addition to examples, we can step back again to more general statistics. Generally, any firm will require a much higher expected return to save energy or water or resources than they will to save labor. For instance, the particular studies I show, and of course this is always a snapshot at one point, but at one point in time, firms were requiring an 8% return before they'd make an investment in saving labor, and a 65% return before they'd make investments in saving energy or resources. And while those exact numbers vary, as the economy changes, that ratio is pretty close.
Why such an enormous discrepancy?
Quite a number of things. Part of it is simply cultural. Firms are focused on saving labor. Labor, sales, and market share is the focus. Other stuff is seen as peripheral, unimportant. Another thing is there are some legitimate things, though they explain only a small amount of it. For instance, there are higher transaction costs per amount saved in saving what's called flow costs compared to labor. But a lot of it is simply the culture. There's also the fact of other types of flaws. For instance, there's split incentives. If you're in a firm, quite often the way accounting is done is if you come up with something that could save energy in your department, the person who can come up with that savings may have the cost fall in a different department. So the person who will put out the money, whose budget the savings will show up on, is different than the person whose budget the cost of saving shows up on. Accounting is still very primitive. And even advanced accounting, when it comes to things like energy, that still happens. Even with the more sophisticated means of accounting, it's very rare to have an accounting that would fully avoid that particular discrepancy.
Now, we're in the time of supposedly the strong shareholder, the almighty shareholder. Everything is supposed to be done for getting the share price up. Why aren't the shareholders concerned about what looks like an enormous waste of money?
There's a whole bunch of things. Now, you've written Wall Street, and you can explain some of that. One of the things is, as you know, shareholders don't monitor details of running a company that much. In practice, the details are decided by management. True, but also, especially, it's hard to pay attention to because even though it's enormous amounts in absolute sense, you know, often it's 10 or 20%. Even if you're talking a very energy-intensive industry, it's not the largest percent. And again, it's the culture. If you look at shareholder, one of the biggest things you can do to drive up shareholder price, lay off some people, even if it damages the firm in the long run. Tell me, you're the author of Wall Street and a bunch of other books since then. Am I wrong?
No, you're right about that. There's this class antagonism to reducing the quantity of and maximizing the control of labor that sort of obscures a lot of other supposedly more hard-headed monetary things.
Exactly. And then there's other things. For instance, a lot of ways avoiding these waste, this type of waste, is not going to happen just on an individual, even an individual firm level. There's a lot of things like trains that need massive public investment, horror of horrors, government spending, and you've got this whole both class interest against it and you've got this whole ideological opposition to it. So to take a case from outside of energy, although it affects energy, single-payer health. If the people who ran General Motors had been concerned primarily with their firm, they would have been campaigning for single-payer health. But you know that they never did and probably never will. That's because the top managers and shareholders in General Motors have to go to the country clubs and spend time with people in other industries, and they would have gotten hell if they'd done that. Also, I don't know this for sure, but maybe some of the managers in General Motors own stock in some of the big insurance companies, and so they have interest besides General Motors in mind.
I want to return to the public investment issue in a moment, but what about pricing? I mean, if we were to, we're seeing, for example, very high gas prices now. If we jacked up the gas price a couple more dollars a gallon, how much of a difference would that make? Could we use pricing really to, how much leverage would pricing have on reducing the amount of energy used and greenhouse gases emitted?
Well, start with, pricing is essential. I mean, you're not going to get it done without pricing. But you can't rely on pricing as the primary driver. And one example of why is this very thing. We've had huge ups and downs in pricing. And if you look at the amount by which it reduces driving compared to the size of the price increase, it's small. You get very small drops in use for very large increases in price. So that's one thing. The other thing is there are things that simply don't get affected by price at all. For instance, as I say, trains are public investment. You're not going to get a train without public investment. No train has ever been built without at least grants at below market cost of rights of ways, and almost always, with very few exceptions, direct public expenditures as well. And to take another case that's at the other end of the spectrum from trains is, what about investment in what about insulation in homes? Well, our homes are drastically under-insulated. When I say under-insulated, I don't mean by green standards, but by simply looking at how much we'd insulate our homes if we wanted to spend less money. Most people could save money by insulating their homes and don't do it. And there are all sorts of reasons, including unequal access to capital, why that happens. That is, first of all, a lot of people rent, and the incentives on giving a gift to your landlord are ridiculous. But also, even if you own your own home, you've got limited borrowing ability, and is putting insulation in your home the first thing you want to borrow money to do, given that you can only borrow so much? So even something like insulating our homes properly requires public investment. The best way to get our homes insulated is to have an offer. If you get a call from your utility company, probably because they've been forced to say, we'll come and insulate your home for free, then you're likely to say yes.
Let's speak with Gaur Lipa, who is the author of Solving the Climate Crisis Through Social Change, out from Prager. Now let's talk some about the public investment. You've got some numbers. How much would it take to get a reasonable start on this project to sustain life on Earth?
Well, if you're talking about in the U.S., a lot, but also not that much in perspective of the economy as a whole, about $250 billion a year. And I will add, that is not all we have to invest. That's just the difference between what we invest now to get dirty infrastructure and what we'd have to do in the way of subsidies or public investment to attract private capital to, in general, do clean infrastructure.
And what kind of things would these finance?
Like I say, insulation in homes, transmission lines to help move, say, wind energy from the Midwest to the West Coast and East, and solar energy from the desert areas to the windy areas. It would finance massive freight rail to help move a lot of the stuff we move now by big trucks to freight trains, and help electrify some of the freight trains, at least on the most heavily traveled route. It would help finance light rail for transit. It would help finance, as I had said, insulation. It would help invest in much more wind and solar electricity than we do now. Possibly there would be some subsidy for electric cars. Also, although this would take very little, it's still public investment, we could finance a lot more in the way of bike paths to help encourage, even though you're never going to get, I think, most of our transportation done by bicycle, still there are a lot of people who like to ride bicycles, and to the extent they do, that's taking a heck of a burden off the rest of the transit system. So it makes a lot of sense to make it easier for people who like to bicycle to be able to do so.
And none of this can be done without the state. It's not, the market is not going to generate these solutions spontaneously, is it?
No matter how high you get the price, it won't, no. There's just too many things that the market can't do. If you want to take an example, you know, when I talked about freight trains, okay, there is a very profitable investment to be made in upgrading our freight rail system to the point where it can replace about 85% of trucking. But the problem is that's a $1 trillion investment all at once. Now, it can be done over the course of 10 or 20 years, but that's still hundreds of billions. A $1 trillion investment, even over the course of 20 years, is quite a large investment, and not an investment that you're ever going to get private enterprise to make. No matter how profitable it is, private companies are not going to get together and stake that much capital all at once on a single roll of the dice.
Now, as far as the class angle on this goes, you give an example of toxic waste and other filthy projects often located next to poor neighborhoods, disproportionately poor and dark-skinned neighborhoods. At the same time, the cultural elite on Cape Cod don't want windmills obscuring their view. How serious an issue is this kind of class angle when it comes to making this transition?
Oh, very serious. You find just about every wind project gets opposition. And while a certain amount of it is legitimate, a lot of it is on very doubtful grounds by people who just don't want to look at wind generators, who don't like the looks of wind turbines, or who have gotten the idea they want. And so you've got somebody, and what it comes down to is, you know, everything has social costs. When it comes to electricity in particular, there's no BTU bunny, there's no kilowatt fairy. But the thing is that when you're talking about coal, you have huge, deadly, toxic social costs, but they can mostly be put on poor people and people who may not be poor, but who are not at the top, who are working class and not at the even the top end of working class, and out of sight of elites, whereas wind generators generally happen in terrain that is are where the elites play. There are various geographical reasons why a good area for wind generation, not always, but a lot of good areas for wind generation are where elites play. One exception are farm communities. And so all of a sudden, you've got a thing as a very little social, tiny social cost on elites versus huge, deadly social costs on working and poor people. And three guesses, which is easier to do in this society?
Now let's talk some about the wind issue. How promising is wind power? How much could it do for us?
Worldwide, wind could supply about five times total energy consumption. That's not electricity consumption. That's total energy consumption. That's on commercially developable sites. Now, you know, that's a first cut, but it's a first cut, as I said, not of all, you know, sites out in the wilderness, and that is legitimately commercial developable sites. In the U.S., I don't know if it's quite five times, but I think if you add everything, the potential is two or three times our current energy consumption. So it's a huge potential. Now, there are reasons you can't supply all our energy from wind. You don't want to monocrop energy any more than you want to do anything else, but it gives you an idea of the scale of what's available from wind.
And what about solar?
Solar actually has much more potential both in the U.S. and worldwide than wind. You could supply several times our current world energy consumption from about 2% of desert land. That's true both worldwide and true in the United States.
They'd like to say on Fox, the wind don't always blow and the sun don't always shine, but clearly we're letting an enormous potential here go to waste. Why is we not capturing this?
In terms of the sun, in all fairness, it's still more expensive than other sources. In terms of the wind, a lot of it is we don't want to do the infrastructure to overcome the fact that the sun doesn't always shine and the wind doesn't always blow. You need storage. You need long-distance transmission. You need demand management, what's sometimes called the smart grid, although a lot of things done in the name of the smart grid are pretty awful, but there are some real technologies that fall under that rubric that are very good. And we're not doing much enough of any of those because it takes large-scale public investment. It's partially the whole economic thing, the ideology against public investment, and partially there seems to be a cultural thing where we don't think big anymore. On that, I'm kind of being speculative, and it's not in the book. But more and more, I see this tremendous resistance to thinking big, even though our country has a huge, long history of thinking big, of doing things like canals and dams and what have you. Not all of them good. I would just say the man in the gray flannel suit would have back in the 50s would have had a heck of a different reaction to global warming than the right wing does today.
Well, we now did see recently a poll showing that finally extreme weather events, the very warm winter in the Northeast, for example, severe tornadoes in the Midwest, finally maybe moving the popular consciousness. Do you see that happening, or are still people capable of telling themselves stories?
I think the resistance to the reality of global warming has never been as big as people think. And more to the point, when you actually look at the solutions rather than the problem, there's huge support. I mean, you talk about renewable energy. Up till recently, it was in the 80s, and it's actually somewhat dropped because Republicans no longer support renewable energy, which they did for a long time. But you've still got a large majority for renewable energy, for efficiency, and even for public investment in green infrastructure. But, and this is an important point about it, what you don't have is it being high on the priority, and that's what hasn't changed. Yet people have always supported environmental causes, but as a low priority, 10th or 12th or 20th down the list from other things. And so when you're talking about radical change, like the change required to solve the climate crisis, it's not going to come just from people who are concerned about the environmental crisis. Although there are people who are for whom environmental causes are a high priority and they're an important, powerful force. But if those people want to win the public, the thing that they've got to do is start understanding that solving the climate crisis is not a unique issue by itself. It needs to be part of a larger struggle. In other words, the old idea of solidarity is now something we need for human survival. Because you've got this problem and unemployment and all sorts of problems stemming from the same thing, you somehow need to get solidarity between environmentalists and union leaders and civil rights leaders and feminists and students and all the different groups. And it's one of the things, for all its flaws, why the Occupy movement gives me hope, because for the first time, you are seeing all these struggles coming together. You are actually seeing solidarity in however imperfect a form. And that is tremendously hopeful.
The anti-environmental right has been somewhat successful in painting these sorts of concerns as elitist. One of the ways they do that is by saying, well, you know, it's a job killer, it's a growth killer, it's just a bunch of, you know, fancy pants in the cities who don't care about the horny-handed sons and daughters of toil. What do you say to that kind of argument?
It's nonsense, of course. Green investment would create jobs, and if you're talking about horny-handed sons of toil in rural areas, fracking is one of the biggest threats to farmers out there. Not only directly destroys some of their land, it destroys their water supply. You can't grow food without water. And in general, if, for instance, we switched our subsidies that currently subsidize massive amounts of corn and use them to subsidize organic soil-building agriculture, that would be a lot better off for at least small and medium-sized farmers. If you're talking about small farmer, which is almost a myth, I mean, most subsidies go to the big farmers, but if you actually wanted to subsidize small farmers, subsidizing organic and low-input agriculture would reverse things and give the small farmers a competitive advantage over the larger ones. So it is nonsense. Of course, a lot of that is cultural signaling. It's not actually based on a rational argument. And I'm always interested in how you deal with that. I mean, one thing that I'm doing is, for example, if I was concerned about global warming, I would write a book on the solutions without focusing a lot on the nature of the problem. Because I think if you take the problem for granted and focus on the solution, you actually do a lot better at selling people on the existence of the problem than if you keep on letting them trap you into arguments about the reality of the problem. Oh, yeah, I actually did that.
Yes, I was going to remind you of that. If you read a lot of the literature or listen to what people say, I mean, some of the climate alarm is the kind of thing that shuts down thinking. You say, oh, this is so terrible, it's already too late, what are we going to do? I throw up my hands and just, like, worry about my day-to-day problems. Your approach is different. You are focusing on what can be done, and it is not impossible.
Absolutely. It's not certainly far from impossible technically, and even though it's difficult, I don't think it's impossible politically. We've seen the impossible happen in politics before. I mean, one of the great causes for hope is always that the world is unpredictable. Politically, you don't know what's possible and what is until you try.
That was Gar Lipow, independent scholar and author of Solving the Climate Crisis Through Social Change, Public Investment in Social Prosperity to Cool a Fevered Planet, just out from Prager. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break to discuss American Decline. That was some of Descent into Hell by the Volcano Sons from 1985. And not coincidentally, my next guest is Edward Luce, chief U.S. commentator for the Financial Times and author of a new book from Atlantic Monthly Press, Time to Start Thinking, America in the Age of Descent. Not dissent as in disagreement, but as in descent into hell. The title comes from the chemist Ernest Rutherford, who said, "Gentlemen, we have run out of money. It is time to start thinking." We haven't run out of money yet, but it is time to start thinking. In this interview, Luce talks about the fiscal cliff facing us at the end of this year. His term refers to the expiration of the Bush tax cuts, combined with $1.2 trillion in automatic spending cuts that Congress decreed should take effect at year-end if it was unable to come up with a credible deficit reduction strategy. I dissent from the urgency of a deficit reduction strategy, but there aren't many of us who think like that. These mandated spending cuts would be socially and economically disastrous. Of course, what Congress decrees, Congress could also undecree, but it's hard to imagine the lame duck session in December coming to any kind of constructive agreement on anything. So what about that approaching cliff? Will we discuss anything like that during the election campaign, or are our leaders and the media too dumb and or devious to do that? Okay, here's Edward Luce. Time to start thinking. We're not doing much of that right now.
Not a great deal, but I would make the distinction between the lack of thinking amongst elected Americans, and particularly at the federal level, but not exclusively, and the degree of alarm that I encounter amongst people in different walks of life, whether you're talking about the academic world or the senior echelons of the Pentagon. There is concern amongst Americans. They just don't happen to be in a position to do much about it.
What about in Washington? You spent a lot of time there. Do you see much of the concern that you talked about just now within the corridors of power and near them?
No, not really. I mean, I see denial from both the campaigns, not just the Romney campaign, but the Obama campaign. Earlier this year in the State of the Union, President Obama cited, although not by name, Robert Kagan's thesis contained in his recent book, The Myth of America's Decline. And the president went on to say, anybody who thinks America's in decline doesn't know what they're talking about. Now, if you look at the numbers of relative economic decline, America had about just under a third of the world's GDP in 2000, at the beginning of this century. 11 years later, it's down to just below a quarter of the world's GDP. That's a kind of natural, inevitable consequence of bigger countries growing quicker, and that's going to continue. So we're probably going to see America's share drop to more like 1/6 over the next 10 to 15 years. That's relative economic decline. I think both campaigns, both the Obama and the Romney campaign, for understandable political reasons, are deploying exceptionalist rhetoric, not only to appeal to Americans, but to try and define the other as being less capable of upholding the American exceptional tradition. I understand the electoral politics of this, but as it happens, it is an intellectual ostrich position. It's a form of denial, and it's not a very healthy premise on which to start a very important general election debate.
At the beginning of your book, you recount a visit to the National Defense University, which is one of the more surprising visits to a military institution that I had heard since of Noam Chomsky's visit to West Point, which was curiously friendly. So tell us about the NDU event.
They select bright sort of mid-career officers from all the services for a year's, intellectual training about strategic thought and choices and global trends. And at the end of that year, every year, they hold this sort of simulation of what the next decade will bring for America. And I was invited to judge and observe this simulation. And what came across was a unanimous view amongst these very bright American senior officers, mid to senior officers, future leaders of the Pentagon, that America is in very rapid decline, and that the military is a consequence of an economy. It was very striking how they saw, look, a strong military comes from a strong economy, and America's overwhelming national security priority must be to rebuild a strong economy at home. And if that includes cutting the Pentagon by 20%, if that includes closing down bases in Europe and other parts of the world, and you know, shoring up in Asia, where the biggest challenges may lie, then so be it. And what really struck me about that exercise wasn't just the intelligence and pragmatism of these soldiers, but it was the fact that, you know, they didn't prioritize defense in their own mind. They had a very clear idea of where America's challenges lie, and it didn't, in their mind, afford a solution by a higher spending on defense or more weaponry.
And you got a similar a line from Mike Mullen over hot dogs.
Indeed, yes. He's since ceased to be the chairman of Joint Chiefs of Staff, but of course he was the most senior officer in for 2-3 years until last October. And he shared that view very strongly and said, look, the strategy where you're borrowing from China in order to build weapons to defend yourself against China is a failed strategy, is a broken strategy. But he also added that America's defense industrial capacity, some of the key manufacturing elements that go into America's military cutting edge, have been lost, and that America simply doesn't have the capacity to build certain things anymore. And, you know, there's barely a military a piece of hardware that doesn't have Chinese software in it.
I was stunned years ago, back in the 80s, when John Lehman, who was Reagan's Secretary of the Navy, said we couldn't build a World War II battleship today anymore. We lack the capacity. So it's gotten worse than that even.
Yes, and in fact, there was a year or two ago, there was a Pentagon report from an advisory group it commissioned to look into critical defense infrastructure. They identified 19 manufacturing, high-tech manufacturing capacities, where 20 years ago, America was number one in all 19, and today was number one only in 6 of those 19. That's a pretty rapid sort of globalization of the supply chain, which, of course, brings definite cost and efficiency benefits to the private sector, but a growing headache for America's defense establishment.
But no, leaving aside the military implications, I mean, you could say this kind of relative decline you've been talking about and the loss of this number one position, you know, so what? We can't be everything. It's a more multipolar world, and we just have to learn to live with it. Is this really a crisis, or is it just something we need to adjust to?
I would agree with you with everything you've just said, in the sense that, you know, we're not talking about absolute decline here. I mean, you know, Britain ceased to be, you know, the global number one about a century ago, but Britain's 4 or 5 times richer. So, I mean, I get, you know, you could take that attitude, let's lie back and enjoy it. But there's another element of decline, you know, which is a bit more subjective. You can't sort of put a number on it. And that is in the American system, economically and politically, as a model for others to follow, as a beacon for others to aspire to and look up to. And I think, you know, what I describe as the missing sense of pragmatism in America's political economy, particularly in Washington, the actions and more importantly inactions of federal politics in the face of this relative economic decline, I think shows a far more disturbing and profound sort of meta trend at work, if you like, and that is that Tocquevillian spirit that Tocqueville, you know, identified almost 200 years ago in America, namely an ability to repair her faults, doesn't seem to be very much in evidence, and it hasn't been in evidence for quite a while. I mean, you'll need no reminding that, you know, we're now entering the fourth consecutive year where Congress will be unable to pass a new budget, or that after the election in what, you know, people are calling the mother of all lame duck sessions, America faces a fiscal cliff, a tax-mageddon, with all sorts of swords of Damocles waiting to fall on the American fiscal situation. And nobody has any confidence, if Congress can't do routine things like passing a budget or you know, funding transportation, that it can solve this very, very momentous, consequential convergence of big fiscal decisions that happen to be coming at the end of this year. But there are real concerns. You've already lost one notch in your sovereign credit rating from Standard & Poor's, and both the main credit rating agencies are watching very, very closely. Does America's political system have the capacity to respond to these problems?
Well, I think people look at that downgrading and say, well, I think interest rates are lower now than they were when the downgrade happened. It doesn't really matter. People still want our treasury bonds, nothing to worry about. Is that an appropriate reaction?
it's half appropriate because, of course, relative to Europe, America, you know, is not on the brink here. And what I'm talking about is not imminent collapse or catastrophe. But that very sort of same normalization of America's problems makes me pessimistic. You're going to have the galvanizing spirit to tackle them. You can acclimatize like the frog in water to gradually heating water. It's far easier to respond, although I don't think Europeans are responding very well, to the shock of being dropped into a pot of boiling water. But yes, at the moment, American borrowing costs are very cheap. When they do start becoming more expensive again, because essentially, you know, interest rates are zero now, when they do start becoming more expensive again, then the debt increase that you've seen over the last few years, most of it necessary, I hasten to add, you know, in the context of a potential Great Depression, that will become a lot more expensive servicing that debt. And it will, in turn, eat further into your budget. Right now, the portion that you call domestic discretionary non-defense budget, that 15% of the budget that includes what I call the tomorrow spending on research and development, infrastructure, education, all the stuff that will boost your future growth capacity, that's going to get eaten to in even further. And the yesterday portion, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, interest payments on past debt, this is going to be taking up an even larger share of the budget. That's not the right direction to be pointing in. The more salient comparison is with just how rapidly the Chinese renminbi is internationalizing, just how rapidly it's becoming a normal international currency. And you cannot take the dollar's international reserve currency status for granted. I think that would be way too complacent at this point.
I'm speaking with Edward Luce, author of Time to Start Thinking, America in the Age of Dissent, D-E-S-C-E-N-T. You say China and the renminbi rapidly taking on role as a reserve currency, but the Chinese have been planning things very carefully over the course of decades, moving gradually, thoughtfully, and designing a remarkable economic transformation with a timescale that's really kind of unfamiliar in American talk, haven't they?
It is unfamiliar. And, you know, at a certain stage, and we might even be in the sort of early stages of it, there's going to be a slowdown in China. You know, there are unsustainable elements to that model. It's not clear it can keep growth up at double digits indefinitely. There's demographic problems facing China. So don't get me wrong. You know, they have problems too. Their fate is linked to yours, to America's. This massive trade imbalance, you know, has the corollary of their funding of your treasury bonds. So this is mutually assured destruction. So it's in both countries' interests to resolve these massive imbalances slowly, gradually, without big disruption. But for China to stop growing, it'll pause for a while, I think, for a year or two, but for China to stop growing would require a cataclysm. It's got four times as many people as you. They're not going to remain a quarter as productive as the American worker. They're getting more productive all the time. So it's inevitably in the next 10, 12 years, possibly much sooner, going to become the number one economy. And when it does, the demand for renminbi, for the yuan, will continue to grow. And unless there is a trust that the integrity of the dollar, namely the political system that manages it, for which the dollar is the symbol in a way, has changed course, changed trajectory, reacquired its ability to take tough decisions and confront America's structural challenges, then you could see a very rapid switch from one reserve currency to another. It's happened before, it could happen again. And there are many respectable, more than respectable economists, including in this town, in Washington, who are now predicting that as a likelihood before 2025, that the dollar loses its reserve status.
Notice several times you say you've been here a long time, but you're still a foreigner visiting the United States. Does this at all remind you of the course your homeland took in the late 19th, early 20th century?
To some extent, yes. You know, Britain in the late 19th, early 20th century was very, very suddenly made aware of the fact. You know, they didn't have numbers, the same kinds of, you know, instant numbers we have nowadays to measure things, but it gradually dawned, well, very quickly dawned upon them in the 1890s that America had overtaken Britain, you know, technologically and in terms of innovation. You know, the Edisons, America, and the internal combustion engine and the electrification, and Bismarck's Germany, you know, seemed to be more cutting edge than Britain. And the way that debate was resolved in Britain, how to respond to this, was to increase military spending and basically leave everything else untouched. And the debate, those on the losing side of the debate, sound very much like a lot of people who today in America who are concerned about American competitiveness, about education system, about the need for training and technical skills and all that. All these same debates were being had in Britain at the turn of the 20th century, and it didn't change course. Because why fix what ain't broke? You know, you've been number one for 100 years. It takes a lot to change course when you've been number one for 100 years. It's been working up until that point. It's others who are restlessly trying different things to see how they can catch up with you. It's you sitting pretty. And it's very, very, it takes something quite big to dislodge that mindset. And I fear the parallel is there in today's Washington. The default mindset is, hey, look, we had Vietnam, we had the rise of Japan in the 80s, we had Sputnik in the 50s, we surmounted those problems, we'll surmount this one too. But I don't see the unifying event that will bring the American people together, that will end political polarization posed by this crisis. I think globalization, technology, the rise of others is actually dividing Americans, whereas the launch of Sputnik instantly united them, or the declaration of war on America by Japan and Germany instantly united them. And even, you know, the threat posed by Japan in the 80s produced a bipartisan response. The Reagan administration was very, very tough and defended the U.S. semiconductor industry to the hilt. You don't see that kind of action today. And it's hard to imagine how, at what scenario we are going to see that kind of action, because polarization is getting worse.
I had thought that going into the financial crisis that might lead to at least something like a rethink, if not a total change of policy. But it seems like there hasn't been much of a transformation of thinking around the finance-centered deregulatory agenda, and it's just we're kind of back to where we were, only a lot less stable and a lot more polarized and a lot poorer in some cases. Were you at all surprised by the fact that the financial crisis did not have that kind of enlightening effect?
Not hugely surprised, although I did expect more of a sort of challenge of basic assumptions, you know, that mainstream economists held, that was the American paradigm from the 1990s, you know, that told us when China joined the World Trade Organization that America would reduce its deficit with China. It was in 2000 it joined the WTO, and of course the deficits exploded. It told us, the conventional wisdom told us, that when productivity grows, wages grow with them. But wages have continued to fall in real terms, so the median household income. It was, of course, the conventional wisdom that brought us the efficient market hypothesis that utterly failed to foresee what the property boom was doing to the American financial sector, and that cost and is continuing to cost Americans so dearly. And it's also the conventional wisdom that continues to tell you today that all we need to do is, you know, fill the gas tank up. The engine's working fine. We just need to get demand back up. But I don't think the engine is working fine. I mean, we've seen a very welcome fall in unemployment in the last few months, 200,000 or so a month, accompanied by, continued over the last 2-3 years in this recovery by falling real incomes for the median American family. The market is clearing at a lower price, even at this fairly anemic rate of recovery. The market's clearing at a lower price. And so there's a structural element to the hollowing out of the American middle class, which I take as the core of the problem here. There's a structural element that is just being completely overlooked. And I think whilst we get that kind of intellectual ostrich stance here in Washington, we're not going to see the kinds of measures that you would need, I think, very desperately. To make the American middle class competitive again relative to their rivals sprouting up all over the world. You know, you need a Marshall Plan, if you like, for middle America, to retrain middle America, to re-equip, re-skill, reinvest in them, give them world-class infrastructure again, give them world-class vocational training, as well as affordable four-year college education for those who want to do that. This is the kind of response, a pragmatic, that the America we used to know would be coming up with. But I hate to sound so pessimistic because, you know, I feel very warm towards America. This book is written out of concern that I don't see that pragmatic spirit, at least insofar as Washington is concerned.
Could it be that the elites are just doing so well that they really have no sense that there's a crisis? They're so divorced from day-to-day life and are looking for growth opportunities far away from their homeland that they just don't care, and then the political system as a result is really unable to respond.
I think that's very, very insightful, and I would agree with you. I mean, if you look at the distribution of income in America, it's sort of taking on Latin American type inequality. Namely that the top 0.1%, 0.01% are taking extraordinary shares of growth. And that in turn, you know, given the loosening of campaign finance laws, gives them greater firepower and an easier passage to influence the political process. That sort of oligarchic quality to American democracy nowadays has a Latin American feel to it. The classic Latin American problem, less so now in contemporary Latin, in places like Brazil and Mexico, which are actually moving in reasonably good directions, but the classic Latin American model is to swing from populism to orthodoxy and back again, in great destabilizing lurches that make sensible governance very difficult. And, I think just as the American economy is taking on Latin American features, so is American politics.
What about the political system? I mean, Obama came into office saying some of the right things, talking about some of the things you've been talking about, infrastructure, rebuilding, refocusing in the long term. Yet we've seen very little of that once he was in office. And then, of course, we have a presidential campaign, which brings out the worst in all of us, and a Republican Party that just gets more insanely right-wing with each passing week. I mean, is there any sign of hope amidst this wreckage, or is it as bad as it looks?
Well, that sort of convergence of big fiscal decisions, you know, the end of the Bush tax cuts, they expire, the sequester, the $1.2 trillion Damoclean sword in the event that Congress fails to produce a medium-term fiscal plan, the sovereign debt ceiling will be breached. It will need to be raised again. All converging at the end of this year could produce that sort of concentration of mind, a wonderful concentration of mind that, you know, unexpectedly produces an outbreak of bipartisan pragmatism. I mean, that's, you know, crises do tend to concentrate the mind, and this has all the hallmarks of a crisis in making. But, you know, to predict how that would go, there are a lot of moving parts there. We don't know who's going to win in November, not just the White House, but, you know, whether the Republicans will retain control of the House. They probably will, I think, but, you know, whether they will gain control of the Senate. There are too many variables to know how this will go, but I think, you know, one thing we do know is there's a kind of moment of reckoning approaching, and we will know a lot more about America's ability to cope with relative decline this time next year than we do today.
Finally, you spent a lot of time traveling around the country to do this book, and one of the features of American life over the centuries has been a real dynamism. It often has been a very brutal place, very destructive place, but there was a dynamism and energy, a creativity to it that at least to me seems to be waning, if not completely gone. What do you think of that? Did you see much of it out in the hinterlands?
I mean, it's very noticeable. I've been sort of living in America on and off, you know, since the late 1990s. And it is very noticeable there is an increase in pessimism. You know, that it's striking the number of Americans who perhaps rightly believe that their children may be worse off than they are. But, you know, as a Brit, you know, we tend to sort of, without knowing it, until we come here, get brought up in a society where it's almost cultured to be pessimistic. And, you know, I'm always refreshed by how optimistic Americans are, even those in the direst of situations. And sometimes that might be an insane and unrealistic optimism, but just occasionally it's self-fulfilling. Optimism, you know, is energizing, and cynicism is de-energizing. I mean, you know, the starting point has to be that you've got some energy, and I do feel you have more. You have more than Europe. I think you've got a lot less, though, than Asia. And I've spent a lot of time in Asia. I lived in India for 5 years as the Financial Times bureau chief there. My wife is Indian. And that frontier feeling is palpable across Asia. And it does seem to be on the wane in America.
That was Edward Luce, chief U.S. commentator for the Financial Times and author of a new book from Atlantic Monthly Press, Time to Start Thinking, America in the Age of Dissent. I wouldn't want to mourn the disappearance of our frontier mentality, which Luce talked about at the end of the interview. It's been the excuse for a lot of brutal acts of appropriation and murder. But if we can't revive ourselves, it might be nice if we did chill out some, if our decline took the form of a somewhat humane, Dutch-style post-imperialism. But I doubt that's the American way. Chaos, polarization, and violence seem more like the American way. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, a bit of a song that I'm playing with no deep political intention, or even a shallow one for that matter, Teenage Head by the Flamin' Groovies. Till next week, bye.
I'm a monster, got a ripped up teenage head.